Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marge Baker of People for the American Way, who assesses the response of the Republican-controlled Senate in handling sexual misconduct charges against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh amid criticism of a long-running misogynist culture among GOP senators. LaShawn Warren of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who discusses a recent government report that finds minority voting rights are under attack with little federal protection. And New Haven High School students who walked out in solidarity with Ecuadorian immigrant Nelson Pinos, who's been living in a sanctuary church for almost 10 months as he fights an ICE deportation order. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The International Criminal Court is opening an inquiry into atrocities committed by the Myanmar army against Rohingya Muslims in the fall of 2017. Over 700,000 Rohingya were forced to flee into Bangladesh as their villages were burned by the Myanmar military, while the civilian government, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, failed to accept any responsibility for the abuses. In recent weeks, a court in Myanmar convicted two Reuters reporters for violating the colonial-era Official Secrets Act in exposing a massacre of Rohingya in a Buddhist village in September 2017. United Nations investigators released a 440-page report laying blame for the Rohingya atrocities on the army. The UN has called for top army commanders to resign and to place the military under civilian control. Among the report's conclusions, the Burmese military explicitly targeted women and children, participated in sexual violence, and used hostile rhetoric against minorities. The Myanmar government, under Aung San Suu Kyi, continues to deny that the military has committed any human rights violations. The Trump administration's Council of Economic Advisers is deliberately undercounting the official poverty rate in the United States. It is part of a broader right-wing campaign to make dramatic cuts to public assistance programs. Meanwhile, nearly half of all benefits going to social safety net programs went to people formerly viewed as middle class, the Congressional Budget Office reported this spring. The U.S. poverty line was calculated in the early 1960s at three times the food budget of a family of a given size, based on food expenses data from 1955. Today, little has changed, despite major changes in the nature of urban and rural poverty. A new measurement, the supplemental poverty measure, takes into account other costs, such as clothing, shelter, and utilities. But critics say it still undercounts poverty. Now, conservative analysts inside the Trump administration, using a new model of consumption to count poor families, says poverty is vastly overcounted. The American Prospect magazine concludes that Trump's Council of Economic Advisers put out a bogus statistical measure on poverty because it's designed to help stigmatize the poor in order to attack the programs that barely keep them afloat today, all justified by dishonest academic research. Conservative commentator Max Boot joined the Anyone But Trump camp in the Republican Party soon after Trump launched his campaign focused on stoking anti-immigrant hatred. Along with other conservative critics of Trump, Boot quit the Republican Party after the 2016 election and soon became a regular pundit on cable news identified with the Never Trump movement. Some prominent Never Trumpers are focused on organizing. In April, neoconservative commentator and Weekly Standard founder Bill Kristol launched a multi-pronged initiative, Defending Democracy Together, to defend free trade, immigration, and special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the Trump campaign's collusion with Russia. Another project, Republicans Against Putin, targeting the Russian president, is in the works. While the number of Americans who identify as Republicans has declined slightly since Trump took office, his base of support, which includes non-Republicans captivated by Trump's populist message, remains a significant force, according to the Christian Science Monitor. Trump's support among GOP voters remains above 80%. Some former Republicans, like Boot, openly hope the Democrats retake the House in this November's election as a check on Trump and Trump's toxic brand of populism. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
The focus of Senate confirmation hearings on President Trump's nomination of appeals court Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court shifted dramatically last week from scrutiny of his judicial record, concealment of tens of thousands of relevant documents, and allegations of perjury under oath to charges of sexual assault. Professor Christine Blasey Ford came forward to say she would testify before the Senate about her accusation that Kavanaugh attempted to rape her during a high school party in 1982, when she was 15 years old. Now a week later, news of another accuser was published in the New Yorker magazine. Deborah Ramirez charges that while she and Kavanaugh were freshmen at Yale University in 1983, he exposed himself to her and thrust his genitals into her face during a drinking game. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program with People for the American Way. Here she assesses the response of the Republican-controlled Senate in handling these charges of sexual misconduct amid criticism of a long-running misogynist culture among GOP senators.
So there are two women who separately have come forward with credible allegations of sexual assault. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford has made serious and credible allegations about sexual assault when they were in high school. And then just recently, Deborah Ramirez, who was at Yale College with Kavanaugh, came forward again with credible allegations of sexual assault while they were at Yale. So there's two women who have made credible allegations. The Republican effort to shut this down has been remarkable even for them. These women are being treated, and certainly worse than Anita Hill, who made allegations against Clarence Thomas many years ago. In particular, what the Republicans are doing is resisting any kind of independent investigation. Dr. Blasey Ford has requested that investigation be done by the FBI, which normally routinely does vetting of potential nominees. And so they've turned down any effort to have the FBI investigate all of the background circumstances around these credible allegations in order to add some additional information and context. And at the hearings that are scheduled for Thursday, where Dr. Blasey Ford is going to be appearing, no additional witnesses will be called. During the Anita Hill situation, there were, I think, 22 outside witnesses called. And these outside witnesses would testify to a context around survivors of sexual assault and how it is totally realistic, for example, that a woman would not come forward at the time of the event and might come forward many years later and have concerns about her own safety and security and whether she would be believed. You would have witnesses to whom she related things in recent years. None of that's being allowed. So it's just Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey Ford turning it into he said, she said, where it makes it look like she's on trial, when in fact what this should be about is investigating Brett Kavanaugh's character and fitness for the promotion that he's seeking, which is a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court.
The Republicans, above all, want to cement in place a conservative majority on the Supreme Court that will hold sway and make important, critical decisions for the American people for a generation to come. And apparently they think that is a more important goal than going through any kind of fair process and getting at the truth about these allegations.
they're weighing both those options. I think we see where they come down. They want that conservative majority regardless of the price.
But that's exactly right. And in the process, I think they're totally undermining the legitimacy of the court, which is a serious problem. I mean, a democracy works because people have faith in the institutions of government, and one by one they're destroying those institutions of government and destroying the American public's faith in those institutions. I mean, how could you possibly believe that someone coming through this process is going to give any litigant before him a fair treatment? This is very clearly part of their plan to pack the court with justices who will rule in their favor. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. It's just not the way it's supposed to work, and it really undermines the legitimacy of the court.
If this nomination goes through, if Republican Senator Susan Collins and Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, both Republicans who state that they're moderate in their politics, if they choose to vote for Kavanaugh and he does take a seat on the Supreme Court, what price will the Republicans pay, if any, for diverting the Senate and the country out of a fair process to understand really who Brett Kavanaugh is?
You know, it's a good question. I think both of the senators come from states where the electorate wants kind of balanced legislators, wants people who are really serious and weigh issues and weigh concerns and come to a considered opinion. I don't see how either of the senators gets reelected if they support Brett Kavanaugh under these circumstances. I have not seen women more mobilized, progressive activists more mobilized around an issue around the Supreme Court during the entire time I've been working on these nominations. People are mobilized. They're angry at the treatment that these survivors are being given. They're angry at the sort of failure to understand survivorship and treat survivors with decency. And they're really fearing what kind of court we could get with somebody like Brett Kavanaugh on the court. So people are mobilized. And I think there's going to be consequences. I mean, there's a backlash, as you and your listeners know probably, to the Anita Hill fiasco that led to the Year of the Women in the Senate. And I think you're going to see that many times over. I mean, you're going to have a situation on Thursday where 11 white men on the Republican side are going to be assessing the credibility of a survivor who bravely is coming forward telling her story. And, you know, nothing's changed for them on that side of the aisle in the years since Anita Hill. I just can't imagine there not being a serious, serious backlash for the Republican Party in the upcoming midterms on this.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program with People for the American Way. Find more analysis and commentary on Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination and the charges leveled against him by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. June 25th marked the fifth anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Shelby County versus Holder case that effectively dismantled the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Since then, more than 20 states across the nation have imposed new obstacles to voting. These include the establishment of restrictive voter ID laws, limiting the days and hours for early voting, and regulations making registering new voters more difficult. These new electoral laws, ushered in by mostly Republican governors and legislatures, disproportionately erode the voting rights of African Americans, Latinos, students, senior citizens, non-English speakers, and other voters viewed as likely to cast ballots for Democratic Party candidates. Now, a new report by the bipartisan U.S. Commission on Civil Rights finds that federal actions to enforce voting rights for minorities have declined sharply since the Supreme Court struck down key sections of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. Catherine Lamone, chair of the commission, called the present state of discrimination against minority voters enduring and pernicious. The report is critical of the Justice Department's enforcement of voting rights laws, both under President Obama and President Trump. Your reporter spoke with LaShawn Warren, Senior Vice President of Campaigns and Programs, with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Here she assesses the commission's report, which concluded that the right to vote for many minority Americans is under attack.
So the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has actually been engaged in voting rights for many, many years. And actually, the recommendations that they put forward in the 60s actually were adopted in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. They recently put out a report that basically validates what the civil rights community has been saying for many years, which is that voting discrimination remains a significant problem in the U.S., and it continues to be a threat to our democracy. We have witnessed many aggressive efforts by state and local officials to limit access to the ballot box. And in fact, we have seen deliberate processes that have been put in place to make voting difficult for people of color, voters with disabilities, and those who have difficulty speaking English. The report that was produced last week basically highlights a number of the problems that remain with respect to voting rights, and basically it highlights a number of the issues, one of which, and it's something that we're seeing not only in our work here in Washington, but we also have a program called All Voting is Local, and our local state directors are seeing some of these same issues. There are a number of polling place closures in predominantly minority communities. We're seeing vote purges. We're seeing strict photo ID requirements that are being implemented. We're also seeing limitations not only on early voting, but also same-day registration. And what's interesting is that a lot of these particular procedures and processes are being implemented in states that were formerly covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was significantly weakened by the Shelby County versus Holder decision in 2013.
In speaking about the Supreme Court decision on Shelby versus Holder, Congress was supposed to fill the gap or rewrite or reformulate that particular part of Section 5 in the Voting Rights Act, but Congress never acted. Tell us about what happened in Congress under Republican control that froze the process in place.
The legislation that has been introduced in order to restore the Voting Rights Act, which is sorely needed, has stalled. I mean, there hasn't been any movement there, but I would say that all parties should have an interest in making sure that all constituents, particularly their constituents, can exercise the right to vote. And I think any effort to allow this, allow the Voting Rights Act to continue to be a weak mechanism such that the federal government has no ability to really make sure that everyone who's eligible to vote can vote is a tragedy, and it's a travesty, particularly given all the things that are happening in our country. So I would say even outside of Congress, there is significant interest, actually, in restoring the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, honestly, we're in a very difficult political environment right now. And so we still are pushing to make sure that we restore the Voting Rights Act. But even in the midst of that, there is a provision of the Voting Rights Act that can challenge some of these pernicious actions by some state and local officials, and that's Section 2, which basically prohibits voting practices and procedures that discriminate on the basis of race, color, or membership of a language minority group. And unfortunately, all of the enforcement has really fallen to private, to nonprofit organizations, to private entities. And so there have been nonprofits, many of whom are part of our Voting Rights Task Force, who have been challenging some of the, like the poll closures and the practices and procedures that limit the right for people to vote. And they've been doing that under Section 2, but I would say, and I think it's important for people to know, that there has been little or no enforcement by the Department of Justice, and they have a voting section and very well equipped to enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but have not done so. And in fact, of the 61 cases that have been filed since the Shelby decision, DOJ has only filed four of them. One was a language access case. And there have been multiple transgressions and problems and violations with the Voting Rights Act since the Shelby County decision, but there's been little or no enforcement by the Department of Justice, and I think we need to ask why. But I think it's important to ground this conversation in the fact that the right to vote is so pivotal and important. It really is the access point to liberation and really to a better life for many people. You know, it allows people to participate in government and gives them an ability to elect a candidate of their choice who will look out for their interests on issues like healthcare, like housing and quality schools and gun control and immigration and the Supreme Court.
That was LaShawn Warren, Senior Vice President of Campaigns and Programs, with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Learn more about voter suppression and the campaign to restore the 1965 Voting Rights Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The fight for freedom for an Ecuadorian immigrant who took sanctuary in a New Haven, Connecticut church almost 10 months ago has heated up in recent weeks with two consecutive large rallies on his behalf. Nelson Pinos took refuge at the First and Summerfield Methodist Church after challenging a deportation order from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. His attorney says that after a court in Minnesota refused to reopen his case, he's now awaiting a ruling by the Board of Immigration Appeals. Pinos and his wife have lived in New Haven for 25 years and have three children who attend primary, middle, and high school in town. His daughter Kelly, a junior at Wilbur Cross High School, recently wrote an op-ed piece published in the New York Times all about her family's ongoing trauma. With the support of Unidad Latina en Acción, a New Haven immigrants' rights group, Kelly and others organized a school walkout on September 20th in solidarity with Nelson, which drew the participation of several hundred students from a number of New Haven schools. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus walked with the students during the protest from their school to the sanctuary church and filed this report. We hear first from high school senior Omar Musa, who explains why he walked out of school on Nelson's behalf.
He got family in here. It's sad to see a story like that. I know his daughter. She's in my school. So, like, we should help to let him live his life in here. So it's a good thing to hope, you know, maybe they're going to work with his case to help out.
Is this a permitted march from school, or are you might get in trouble for walking out? What's that about?
No, it's from the school. We have his daughter. She asked the principal to go out. We got permission from the school to go out with the, like, with his daughter and stuff.
What do we want?
Nelson's freedom.
What do we want?
Now.
What do we want?
Nelson's freedom.
What do we want?
Now.
Indigenous activist Norm Clement addressed the crowd from the steps of the First and Summerfield Church. His comments were informed by his own experience of family members being separated by U.S. policy toward indigenous peoples.
Hey, everyone. My name is Norm Momowitu Clement. I am a Confederate, Quinnipiac Native, and a Penobscot. And in case no one has mentioned this yet today, we are on stolen land. All right? This is stolen land, and no one is illegal on stolen land. The indigenous people is right, and Nelson is an indigenous person to these territories. Just as all people who were born in North America and South America are indigenous people to here. You see what my shirt says? No borders. My people had no borders. People traded freely from the south to the north for thousands of years. It wasn't until colonialism came along and put up borders and now walls so that families would be separated. This is nothing new. Families have been being separated for 500 years in these territories. Ever since that supposed discoverer came here, You know the guy I'm talking about. All you students, you know his name. What's his name? Christopher Columbus! That murderer, that rapist. He was going to India, supposedly, but his mission was to take advantage of whatever people he came across. And that's what he did when he came here. And that oppression hasn't stopped just because there's a new president in town. That's a system of white supremacy that we need to take down. We need to knock it down from its roots. And that's all part of what we're doing. And it's part of why we fight for Nelson. Nelson belongs here as much as anybody does. Nelson's family belongs together. The separation of families that is happening and has been happening specifically under this president, but for many, many years. There's so much devastation. You know, we just heard that another 1,500 kids are lost in the system. They can't be found. That's on top of the other 1,500 that they found and still can't reunite with their families. That trauma carries generation after generation. It doesn't stop when they go back to they find their mom and dad. That doesn't stop. They're afraid every single night after that's going to happen again. The trauma that is being caused by this government, a crime against humanity. We need to really start thinking about those things as we go forward. I'm just proud to be here today because Nelson has become a friend of mine. But it doesn't matter whether it's Nelson or it's Marco Reyes or it's someone else up in Hartford. We need to bring all these families back together so they can start healing.
That was Indigenous activist Norman Momowetu Clement speaking at a rally for Nelson Pinos, who's been in sanctuary in a New Haven, Connecticut church since early December of last year. Learn more about Pinos' sanctuary status and local groups who support him by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.